Welcome to Season 8, Episode 11 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we discuss the Emerald City Comic-Con lawsuit. We also talk about how real-life experiences have actually affected how we run or play our various role-playing games. Again, welcome to Season 8, Episode 11 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff, and joining me this episode is Tristan and Chris. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hey, good to be back.
Yeah, it's exciting, you know, and I have to say I'm kind of excited about the topics this week.
Yeah, some good stuff here.
Yeah. But before we get that, I think one piece of news and a few Kickstarters. So you want to get into that, or do we have something we need to talk about first?
No, let's go right and crack right on into it.
Yeah, we don't really usually have anything before the news. We're just like, let's get it. I guess the big news is kind of Paizo. They've announced that they're going to, and I think this will be available at Gen Con is kind of what I've gotten the impression of.
So this is coming August of next year.
Is it next year?
Yeah.
Okay. Because where is it? I think I read... let's see. Because I sent it to Evernote. I must have not moved it. Because they had an announcement. Yeah, 2017. Yeah, so next year. And it's supposed to be 500 pages. But it is their Starfinder RPG, which basically is, for lack of a better term, Pathfinder for science fiction. And actually, Chris, you were mentioning that this sounded familiar, what they've described here.
Actually, yeah. Like, I was looking through this sucker just recently, and I'm just reading over the different comments here. How it's a standalone role-playing game that's backwards compatible, how it's science fantasy... set in the Pathfinder campaign universe, features space battles, power armor, rat folks, and technomancers, how androids are going to be a core race, and my first thought is, I'm getting a serious case of deja vu. Okay, I'll go to a full confession time. I like mixing a little bit of sci-fi elements in my fantasy. I own a copy of Expedition of the Barren Peaks, I own the DA trilogy back in the day, and I like collecting, you know, I was a fan of Spelljammer when it was high days of second edition. And so I collected the Adventure Path of Iron Gods and the associated support material here. Mm-hmm, and I'm noticing a lot of crossover.
Yeah, it looks like it said that they had mentioned that that they had started putting little hints in about their about the space campaign all the way back to their early adventure paths. So... yeah, that doesn't surprise me. And when that particular one that you had just mentioned came out, I looked at it and got, oh, this is taking a real sci-fi vibe to it. I wasn't at all surprised when they announced, you know, that this was coming, you know, shortly thereafter.
Yeah, like it's a good module series, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they're going to do to compile it. But it sounds like they're compiling a lot of their data and trying to add a few, you know, trying to push the envelope just a little bit more to see what happens. I guess this would be their equivalent of Star Frontiers, ultimately.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know, and it'll be fun to see what they come up with there. But, I'd be interested in seeing if they're going to pull up the Lovecraftian elements of the original material. Like, an entire section of Iron Gods is basically you versus Mego, which is always fun. Huh. And we'll see where that goes.
Yeah. It'll be interesting. But, yeah, they said Gen Con 2017 will be a 500-page core rulebook. Is what they're saying. And they actually, in the press release that I got emailed to me, they also mentioned some other stuff coming up in the following year. Includes things like they're going to actually overhaul and do a full conversion of their Curse of the Crimson Clone. Not clone, crone. I can't speak right now. I think I'm going to have another sip of my beer, and we'll go from there.
That's the spirit.
There you go.
Crimson Throne. There we go. And it's going to be a 480-page hardcover.
Wow.
You know, and they also, I guess, in August of this year, they're actually going to produce the Core Rulebook and Bestiary as softcover pocket editions.
Oh, interesting.
You know, $25 right now for the core rulebook and $20 for the bestiary.
Now, see, that's actually really good.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting. I don't know. What's the size of a pocket edition? I mean, what's the...
Usually they're more like that sort of manga size than the traditional, you know, 8.5 by 11 style books that you normally get.
I mean, what is that? I mean, what is... I mean, I guess...
It's more like a... I don't know. I don't have a manga sitting here in front of me to give you dimensions, unfortunately.
Like 6x10, 6x...
More like 6x8, maybe.
Interesting. I wonder, I mean, does that require reformatting for them, or is it going to be...
I would imagine some. I mean, I've seen... was it... Savage Worlds has a pocket edition, as opposed to their, you know, traditional size rule book. So,
so it's about the size of the Explorer edition?
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be, it would be my guess that would be something in that neighborhood.
Wow, that's going to, I mean, it's already 500 pages.
Yeah, that's going to be a huge little tiny book.
I mean, you know, that's something that, you know, you, it's like, here, strongman contest, rip these phone books, basically.
Oh, nice.
What?
You're not supposed to be longer than you are wide. I'm just saying. Yeah. But the thing is, like, I collected some of the other relief material. Like, they actually did their universe called Distant Worlds. They did a few races. They did a race book as well. And they actually did a book on all their crazy high-tech items with the understanding that it probably would break over time. In fact, in the Pathfinder universe, there's a place called Numara, not to be confused with Numenara from Monty Cook. Where basically it's a place where a spaceship crashed and basically mucked up the land. So it's actually written within the Pathfinder environment before you even get started.
Yeah, and they're going to have apparently Starfinder adventure paths as well, is what they're saying in here.
Cool.
Very neat.
I just hope one of the requirements is gold lame, because you know it's not a good space opera unless you have gold lame involved.
Oh, absolutely. You've got to have that.
And of course, it's going to be OGL, so third-party people can make stuff. All right, well, that's Starfinder. Shall we get into the Kickstarter, shall we?
Yes, go ahead and get right into them.
First one is a... I like the description of this. Universal Exploits. This is probably not your sleazy 70 science fiction game.
Oh, God.
Oh, nice.
I don't know why, but I just thought that was hilarious. That's just bad. You know, this is very definitely not PC here. In this age, has taken a lot of inspiration from sci-fi porn parodies. I don't even want to know.
Thanks, Comedy Rob.
That's just bad. I mean, I guess this, you could almost say this is like, I don't know. I guess this is kind of, well, when was Barbarella, the Jane Fonda movie? Was that in the 70s or late 60s?
I think it was like 68, but I'd have to check.
Yeah, was it like 60s? Sure. Yeah.
I mean, that's what I kind of imagined for this, in a way.
Either that or that parody of Flash Gordon or Flesh Gordon or something.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Oh,
yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they've already reached their goal, but I'm just like, I just thought that was funny.
Right. You know. Yeah.
You know, before.
Sorry, go on.
I don't know. Before we get really weird, you know, fan mail, it's like, I don't know how to. It's
a thing.
It's a thing, and it's just kind of a weird thing. But, you know, because one could argue that, hey, you know, this is, I don't know, basically a male-only game, kind of, or male fantasy game. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say.
Yeah, true enough. Well, the thing is, I'm actually running a 70s game right now, but it's like a totally different feel for that.
Yeah, what's interesting is they say the animated science fantasy film Star Chase: The Legend of Orin came out in 1985, so he uses some of that for inspiration. I've seen that movie.
Yeah, he's also inspired by films such as Ice Pirates, Flash Gordon, Barbarella.
Yeah, I was right, Barbarella.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, so it's kind of hard, I don't know, I mean, I guess if everyone has a sense of humor and can take it for what it is, then I guess okay.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What is he asking for PDF? $10.
It's not bad.
Oh, I don't. Yeah. Actually, that's not. I don't know. Hey, hold on. Is that the rule book?
Here.
I guess that is the rule book. Yeah, that's just weird. All right, definitely have to have a sense of humor to play that one, though.
Yes.
I might go back to right next to your book of erotic fantasy if you actually have a copy.
I don't know why when I'm thinking of sense of humor, the only thing I can think of is you ever see My Blue Heaven with Steve Martin?
Yeah, that's the one with Rick Moranis as well.
Yeah, Rick Moranis, he plays the FBI agent. Funny thing is they were supposed to do the opposite roles.
It worked. Either way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Steve Martin was supposed to be the FBI guy and Rick Moranis was supposed to be the gangster, but they decided it would work better the other way. But in there, Steve Martin's character says, you know, who the hell was it? Joan Cusack was like talking about, I have a sense of humor. He says, really? He says, you know, what's the difference between a light bulb and a pregnant lady? And the punchline was, you can unscrew a light bulb.
Oh, harsh.
but just the way he delivered it, and you're just like,
yeah.
You know, it's just like, he says, see, no sense of humor.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, when you're dealing with that weird crossover group of the SCTV SNL crowd during the 80s, that was like comedy gold, man.
Yeah. I mean, that's an older movie, but... I still remember the other line from that movie, and she's like, it's like, listen, have you ever been wrong before? Yes, I've been wrong before. Let me guess, the shoes. I don't know why. So anyway, we're going to go talk with, I love Steve Martin, what can I say? Fantasy Adventure, Module BR5, Island of the Ancients. It's reached its goal. It says it's compatible with first or second edition AD&D, and if they reach their stretch goal, they'll make a fifth edition a compatible version, which I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's kind of one of those weird ones.
Well, once again, it's nostalgia for the good old days, you know, when everything had a letter and a number designation to it.
Yeah, well, trust me and my friend just talked about chickens and how they have at least a dex of 14 or higher and probably, you know, an AC of 1. Anyway...
Don't get me started on the legendary conversation of all time, cats versus commoners. Where okay. Do you stand?
Okay, we won't. Anyway, so let's see. What are they asking for here? $15 for the PDF version, which I guess is not too bad. I don't know how many. Do they say 6 to 8 players, level 7 through 9? That's all. They don't actually say how large it is. At least I'm not finding it.
Yeah, I'm not seeing it right off here either.
Imagine if they're going for the oldest.
It says expect the module to be 40 pages when it's complete.
Eh, you know, okay. That's okay.
Yep.
All right, this one just sounded weird. Goblin Punk, a Pathfinder compatible adventure. Across the countryside, goblins have been raiding and pillaging with blimps and clockwork weapons.
Oh, jeez.
So. I just think that just sounded funny.
That does sound funny.
You know, it's a good game when the Zeppelins are involved.
Zeppelins?
Indeed.
So, what are they asking for this? Again, $15 for the PDF.
Not too bad.
That might be fun for the lulls.
Yeah.
You know, basically just present it as a party here. Get your party together and say, okay, does everybody have their characters done? Awesome. We're playing this. Just let their eyes bug out.
Compatible, exactly. Yeah, will be a fully Pathfinder compatible for characters 1 through 10. 30-page adventure. So I guess that other one's not too far off then, okay. It's about $15 for... You know, I don't know. I haven't paid for an adventure in a while, so I'm out of the market on that one.
I don't know. For some reason, I see doing a really great parody of Invasion USA, or, you know, this way you could actually stream Wolverines and have real Wolverines involved.
Yeah, there you go.
I like it.
So I got a question. Anyone ever use, I don't know how long you guys have been around, ever use a piece of software called TableMaster?
No.
I'm sorry, man. No.
Neither have I. But apparently, the gentleman, I think it's a gentleman, because I don't know if it's Jean or Jean McGuire. I'm not sure if it's male or female, because that can go either way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If someone knows, please enlighten me. invented a piece of program called Table Master, and it's basically an automated way to create tables that enroll them. I think that's I'm not sure if that's quite doing it justice, but it's like, I guess it had tables and you could embed tables and you could, I'm guessing from the way he described it, you could actually sit down and, like, not that there aren't already, isn't already software out there for it, but you could do things like the whole traveler planetary creation.
Oh, okay.
Bless
you. Yeah. The only thing that I don't like about the description here is he talks about some table packs, but he doesn't describe what they're going to be. He's keeping that a little bit tight to his chest.
Yep.
Did I? Oh, that's, yeah.
Well, the big thing I would like to know, if somebody asks about this, the question you'd like to ask is whether where the gauge is just strictly for recreational use, or could you use it for something like commercial use, ultimately? You know, use it to help generate the thing and basically better, say, like a PDF or something. Or your website or something. That'd be curious to ask.
Well, I know that I looked at his website, and he has a fact where he talks about he wasn't going to provide a way to exchange the tables. You know, because these are tables that get, you know, it's basically kind of an automated thing. That's what the table packs are for. You can go in there and automatically generate all that stuff.
Right.
He wasn't going to provide that just because, you know, again, there's that copyright issue.
Yeah, that's a good reason.
So I say I keep using he. I have not, unless someone can tell me any different, I'm going to say he. But
yeah, that's right here.
The only thing is that they have 24 days to go. They were wanting $2,500, but they only have $539 at this time. You know, so it's kind of, that might be a hard press. The claim is they've done it 90% complete. And when I looked at their fact on some other stuff, I guess he's writing this in Delphi.
Strange.
What was it?
Strange, but go on.
Well, I think that's because he wrote the original one, according to him, in Turbo Pascal.
Man, that's a name I haven't heard in a while.
What, Turbo Pascal? Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, I learned how to program in Turbo Pascal a long, long time ago. I think I wrote my first traveler planetary generator in Pascal. You know, to generate a whole subsector at a time. Just run a program, and it would generate a thing and print it out on the printer.
Right on.
Oh, there you go. So I thought that was kind of interesting. So let's get through the rest of these so we can actually get to the good stuff. We have this one. It's in the UK, right? Or Europe.
South Wales. So, yeah, UK.
Yeah. I like the idea of it. I love the little miniature furniture for miniatures. For tabletop use. Unfortunately, has $7 and one backer right now. 40 days to go. Looking for in the U.S. conversion, about a little under $1,200 or $12,000. So the sad thing is, I don't expect this to happen. But no. The photo that he has looks good. I'm guessing.
Oh, it looks fantastic for what it is.
Yeah. I mean, these are the type of things that, you know, because it's like, this is what I've taught. I mean, I'm guessing I'm guessing it's wood, kind of like some of the other stuff I have, you know, from other stuff. And this is the funny thing. This thin plywood that we, you know, people can use the laser cutters and stuff on. This is perfect for this kind of stuff. Because the problem with, like, I've had, like, miniature lead freaking tables and chairs, and they're just too heavy, and they're never really proportioned correctly. They're always just kind of a really weird approximation.
Yeah.
You know? Not to mention they're fucking expensive, so why would you buy a set of chairs? So, I like the ideas of this. I love the beds. I mean, I don't have a bed. You know, I like the idea of the beds. Hell, I think there's even a crib. That's kind of funny. Not funny, but, you know, kind of cool. But, you know, I like the idea of this set, but I just don't think it's going to probably pan out.
Yep. No, probably not, but still, well, nice to look at.
Yeah.
Well, the big problem, again, is shipping. It always comes down to shipping. Like, it looks like it's really well done. Probably can make it relatively cheaply, but I would imagine that...
Well, and actually, I should mention that, according to this, it's only to the United Kingdom, so we can't back it anyway.
Okay.
So, yeah. Which again, is going to be a problem for his $1,200 startup costs.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, okay. That's kind of cool. I just wanted to mention it because I think that kind of stuff is interesting. And so we have two more. One is the Elderlands D20 RPG, which is just another fantasy game. They're looking for $30,000 and they have 90 bucks.
Oof.
So $30 for the rule book. It looks like. And, you know, it's just kind of stupid. And then a $15 to occasional examples to teach players unfamiliar to use functions. So you can have your name reference if you pay $15, and there's 50 of those available. Yeah, there's a lot of risks. It's still a work in progress. I don't know. You know, I mean, I'm never opposed to a new fantasy game, but this is a fantasy game based on D20. We have a lot of those.
Yeah, we do indeed.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see how they do the damage reduction, but other than that, I haven't heard much from him. I would say if he wants to present anything, now's the time to present it. Well, he's still got quite a bit of time left.
Yeah. Yep.
Otherwise, he's not going to make it here. Like, I don't know if you listen to our podcast, but I'd say go out there and try to promote the hell out of it right now just to see if it's even viable, because ultimately, it doesn't matter what system you use, whether it's a good game or not, that determines the best.
Yeah, no. I mean, yeah. So, yeah. And finally, just because we have, I like miniatures, the RPG Tablecloth Battleground, which is basically just, it's a cloth that has a pre-printed background, and he's going to have an ocean, a forest, a cave, village, ice, mountain, swamp, sand, and desert. Well, I guess, you know, sand and desert are two different things, technically.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, but it's expensive.
Yeah.
How big is this thing? Did he say? I don't see measurements. Did I miss it? Okay, here we go. 1.5 meters by 2 meters. That's actually pretty big.
Yeah, 59 by 79, so.
You know, but that said, it's $30 for, well, actually, it's not even, depending, it's 35, I'm sorry, I said $30, that's 30 pounds, or euros. It is
$34.
It's about $40 US for one of their, you know. And it looks like it goes up from there. Actually, I take that back. Those are his next designs. I guess the two designs that they're working on now is the Barren Wasteland and the Ancient Ruins.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know. And they give you photos of that. I like the Barren Wasteland one. The Ancient Ruin one, doesn't float my boat.
Well, it feels done to script.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does, kind of.
You know, but I get it. So.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's all the Kickstarter. Shall we get into the real meat and potatoes of the discussion?
Yeah, let's go right ahead and get into it.
All right, so a while back, a few weeks back, I happened to catch this. The post that I'm going to include in the show links for this happened May 18th. So, I mean, it's, what, a couple of weeks ago? 3 weeks ago?
Yeah, a couple weeks ago.
That?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But apparently, some people are suing the Emerald City Comic Con for not paying the volunteers. The argument goes that the Comic Con treated their volunteers like employees, therefore they should be compensated as employees. That's kind of the narrative of the lawsuit. Now, basically they're saying there's about roughly maybe about 250 people that would volunteers that would fall into the category of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought it was interesting because, you know, volunteering at a convention is kind of one of those time, I want to say time honored, but time, I'm going to go with time honored because I don't know how to describe it, things that happen. Or something that's been happening since any convention I've ever seen, where it's like, you know, you have volunteers. Heck, you have some, you know, and it's like, it's weird because it's for smaller conventions, that's the only way they can really operate. You know, that's the only way you can even build a convention. It's like, hey, you know, I'm going to have a convention, you know, and usually at that level, you know, everyone's doing everything anyway. no matter whether they volunteer or not. And it's like, hell, even the guy running the convention isn't getting paid. He's just spending his own volunteer time. And then when you go up to, obviously, like something like a Comic-Con or like Gen Con, those are businesses, period. Whether look at Gen Con. How big is Gen Con?
Huge.
I mean, how many people went last year? 60,000 some odd, right?
Something like that, yeah.
You know? That's a lot of dough. Not to mention all the money that people spend there. Not to mention, I mean, the cities love it. I mean, there's a reason that Indianapolis loves Gen Con. I heard once that, and this was back before it reached 60,000, that it brought in the same income to the city as 1/5 of a Super Bowl event there.
Yeah.
That's a lot of fucking money.
That is a ton of money.
You know, there's a reason that they didn't want the convention to move, although it desperately needs to, but I have no idea where it would go.
Right.
And that's not a damnation of Indianapolis. Indianapolis is a great city. It's a great, you know, I've met wonderful people there, you know, that live there. And I know some wonderful people that live there, and I've been able to crash at people's houses there for Gen Con, which is about, these days, about the only way you can go to Gen Con.
This is the point where you thank Zach, obviously.
Well, Zach, yeah, Zach and his buddies. And, you know, if it wasn't for those guys, there's a few times I would have never went to Gen Con. But that said, the housing has become insane there. I mean, you know, the hotel stuff has been insane there. They're not going to build enough hotels. They, you know, the transportation, you know, there's hotel issues, there's transportation issues, whatever. But whether you like it or not, Gen Con is a business. They run it as a business, and it is for profit. And I'm sure the Emerald City Comic Con is basically a for-profit event at this point. I think all conventions want to eventually be for profit. Whether you like to admit that or not is another story.
Right.
They're not a 501c, as we call them in the United States. You know, they're not a nonprofit organization. They could be. I have no idea. I don't think that that's the case. And that was the other argument in this thing, is the fact that the volunteer work stuff, a lot of the law that's built around volunteers is built around nonprofit organizations, not necessarily things like conventions. So, you know, the question is, well, even though they're volunteering, you know, they're not protected from not being paid, because the way the labor laws are written in the United States, technically they could be considered employees because the entity is not a nonprofit. That's one of the arguments in this case, I think. You know, so, I mean, I don't know whether it is or it isn't. But I think we need to watch this very closely, because this has major ramifications. I mean, yes, this is one suit and one small court in the United States. But once someone decide, like, let's say the courts decide in favor that, yes, these people are employees, that's one case law. You don't think someone's going to use that bit of case law in an attempt to enact, you know, take another entity to court, citing that as a reference, if you will.
Right. I mean, basically, this is opening up a huge rabbit's hole. Once, you know, somebody gets, once there's a verdict that says, yeah, you know, these people are technically employees, you have to pay them as such. I mean, you're basically opening it up so that all of a sudden now every convention, you know, anybody who volunteers or has ever volunteered, all of a sudden will be considering themselves, well, hey, you know what? I should be getting paid for my time, you know, to do this. And once that happens, I think you're going to see, you know, that a lot of these conventions, as big as they are going to have a hard time staying afloat, and then little conventions are going to become practically non-existent.
Right. Well, I mean, and it's not just gaming conventions. This would apply to any type of convention, because I look at it. I mean, this has ramifications to things like, I don't know. I mean, hell, let's just look at the, what the fuck is the big electronics convention in Vegas? Shit. I should know this one.
Yeah. Oh. Oh, what's the name of that thing?
But I mean those type of conventions. Those are industry conventions, you know. And it's like, I'm sure they have volunteers for that too, believe it or not.
Is that International Consumer Electronics Show?
Yeah, I think that's it.
Yeah, I think that's it, yeah.
But okay. I'm just saying, I'm sure there are volunteers for that as well. You know, I'm sure, I can't imagine any convention not having volunteers of some sort to do even just basic things, you know, like, I mean, hell, I'm sure even if they paid almost everybody, well, maybe someone volunteers to help, you know, freaking, I don't know, direct traffic or handle parking. Who knows? You know, there's always something right. that somebody might be able to volunteer for. It's like, or just even, hell, let's just say this. I'm going to volunteer my time to act as a as an on-site EMT.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. if this goes through, I mean, if it proves that you should have to pay your employees, well, then you got to pay an EMT rather than have someone volunteer to do that work. Because, I mean, I know a lot of places that that happens as well. You know, they're like, hey, I'm an EMT in real life. You know, I like conventions. I like this convention. You know, if, hey, you know what? The only thing I expect is, hey, I'll work it and, you know, hang out, do my thing. You know, because I like helping people and I like conventions. I, you know, in the case of something like Gen Con or Comic Con, I love watching the cosplayers. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure they might pay. They probably pay those people. I'm not sure how that actually works, but I'm just using that as an example of something that might happen. So, but on the other hand,
I could say, you know, just speaking for myself, as someone who has volunteered at a number of different types of conventions in the past, usually, I mean, the deal is that you volunteer to be at the convention to help out, you know, doing whatever it is that they want you to do. And usually the way it works is you have to volunteer doing something for X number of hours, you know, of the con every day that the con is operating. But then once you're done, you know, with your time, you know, once you put your time in, then you're free to just go run around the con and do whatever you want. And that's kind of the trade-off.
Right. Is, so, I mean, the
you
know, question...
You don't have to pay to get in. You just have to, you know,
right.
go
but
and
the question,
work for several
hours. I guess the question is like, in this case, were they expecting, like, these volunteers to be working 12 hours a day or 8 hours a day?
Right. I mean, I guess that is really the question. I mean, we don't know all the details, you know, behind the lawsuit.
You know,
we don't,
I mean, and... You know,
right,
I mean
are they expecting them to pull, you know, 10, 12-hour shifts? I mean, you know, over the weekend, is that what they're expecting? Or, I don't know.
Don't get me wrong. I've done nonprofit work before where I have worked over a weekend, like 12 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I used to, this has been a long time ago, but I used to do, you know, I'm an amateur radio operator, and one of the local groups works a lot of public service events where we provide communication supports for various, you know, we're talking, you know, hikes, bike rides, you know, walks, whatever, you know, because, you know, these organizations, you know, that run, you know, these, like, for example, the big example that the example I'm thinking of is the MS-150.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which is a huge bike ride. It's a 2-day event, you know.
Yep.
I forget if one, I think it's 150 miles or is it 150 kilometers? I forget which one it is. But, you know, that's a 2-day event, you know, and it takes a lot of work, a lot of volunteer work. It's like, you know, you're providing communication support for people, you know, for the organizers of the event. The organizers are all volunteer. You know, in that case, everyone there is a volunteer, no matter who, what level. Almost nobody's getting paid for those events outside of a few people, probably.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't run that event without a volunteer force. Now, granted, it's all nonprofit anyway, so...
Right.
It doesn't fall under this law. But my point is that, you know, the expectation there is that we would be working, you know, probably 8 to 12 hours because of the way, just the nature of the ride, you know. So.
And I guess that's, I mean, that's really the question is, you know, what was the expectation, you know, of the volunteers when they went in? You know, was that expectation then, you know, blown away, you know, by what was actually the reality of the case?
Right.
And is that where, you know, the lawsuit really stems from.
Right. I mean...
See, I mean, you know, we don't know all the specifics. That's
yeah,
kind of...
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if, like, for example, you volunteered for something and for some reason you're like, I can't do this, and you left, if they were going to try to, I don't know, claim they were going to sue you for, like, breach of contract or something. I don't know.
Well,
I mean...
yeah, I don't know. I can't imagine that. That...
No, I know that, but you never know. I mean,
but you never know, right. I mean, yeah,
you don't know. Again... Mm-hmm. Nothing in this article actually clearly talks about, you know, they just talk about wages. So basically, some people decided that the work they did needed to be paid for. Now,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Again, you know, it's gonna be interesting because, like I said, this will have interesting ramifications across all conventions.
If
it does happen.
Well, again, a lot of these things, especially when it comes to, like, this is more of a Comic-Con, what I'm reading here, as far as popular media and stuff. But when it comes to a lot of gaming conventions, especially the recent ones that were created by Kickstarter and a prayer,
Yeah.
This could end that real fast.
Right. No.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so, yeah. I mean, yeah, I mean, this is a Comic-Con, but most Comic-Cons have gaming. That's why we're covering our, although, I don't know.
Well, again, it's like, often you use the reference of, we're doing model railroads.
Right.
Would you pay to set up a model railroad for somebody else? Should you be paid for it, ultimately? And without knowing the actual specific details, we're just chasing shadows, ultimately.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I guess the reason I bring this up, because, you know, I mean, I posted this out, and of course the response was, no, they're volunteers. And I'm like, hey, I hear you. I mean, I agree. If it is a true volunteer situation, and the demands were that of what you would expect a volunteer to be okay with, then yeah, probably they shouldn't be paid. But we don't know that.
Well, again, if you have a volunteer organization, you're going to have to take care of them if you want to have them back next year.
Well, that's it,
like,
too.
There's a lot of tangential benefits and so forth. Like, often there's a volunteer party afterwards. Often meals are covered.
Yeah, I mean,
and so forth. Like, well,
But I mean, I'm going to use another example. We have a science center here, and it heavily relies on volunteers. It really doesn't. A lot of the people doing some of the science exhibits, they're all volunteers. None of them get paid. And matter of fact, actually, hell, one station, they couldn't get paid for anyway, because, well, they actually have volunteers that work their amateur radio station that they have there. And as part of the amateur radio bylaws, you can't be paid for doing amateur radio stuff. Which, again, is why even when we work public service events, no one can get paid as an amateur radio operator for those either. That's just not what... Basically, you can't be paid to be an amateur radio operator. Does that make sense? Because then, therefore, you're not really an amateur.
Right, exactly. Once they're getting paid for it, you become a professional.
I think,
right?
I think there are some leeway in that, Justin. I forget but I mean, that's more along the lines of, hey, I'm a police officer, but I'm also an amateur radio operator, so I can interface with those guys, you know, kind of thing.
Right.
Rather than, you know, you're actually getting paid. That's not your that's just your primary job. But, you know, but getting back to the science center thing, they tend to burn out a lot of their volunteers very quickly. That's a problem with the organization, you know, that they're burning out their volunteers. And I mean, the same thing applies to conventions where, you know, maybe these people felt that they were just being worked to death, and it's just like they felt they should be paid, and the actual answer is, screw getting paid, you should just say, I'm never doing this again.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't really know what the answer is here.
No, that's understandable. Well, again, quite a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, I used to volunteer at the University of Alberta Provincial Museum.
Mm.
I was basically training to be an archaeologist, and got the degree and everything, and basically, I spent a lot of time organizing little projectile points for hours and weeks on an end.
Did some flint napping?
Pardon?
Did.
Yeah, I can flint nap.
Sweet. You know, my buddy can flint nap.
Oh, sweet. We'll compare notes. That's awesome.
Well,
compare naps.
Well, I'm just saying, long story short, you know, I've actually done three archaeological digs myself.
Oh, right on. Yeah. So, basically, in my humble opinion, now this is going to go a little bit off topic, but I guess hear me out. A good museum has two things they have to present. They have to present the facts and the information, but they're also a learning center for that community. And if they don't tie themselves into the community, it's just going to be essentially a fishbowl, you know, a fishbowl. And how do you get that? Volunteers. And if you burn out your volunteers, ultimately, it's going to become a morgue.
Exactly. So, anyway, I figured we just needed to talk about this because, I mean, this like I said, we're going to have to see what happens eventually in this case. And when, hell, we ever hear news about it, I'll let everyone know what we've seen. Because it's going to have some, I suspect what's going to happen is the lawsuit's going to go nowhere.
Yep.
That's my viewpoint just at this time. That's not to mean that, I still don't know the particulars about the case. And maybe when the particulars come out, maybe there will be a change. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, if there is a ruling in favor of the group doing the lawsuit, whatever the ruling is, it's very narrow. Because if they, you know, again, it's called, you know, it's that case law bit, you know. It's like, well, then it, you know, it's an example of what happened, you know, results in a case, and now all of a sudden people can use that as references and other things, and you know, it's that weird domino effect. Now another jurisdiction might say, even with that, it still doesn't apply, you know. But it, like I said, you know, one stone at a time, you know.
Exactly. So. It's just going to be more interesting to see what happens with this, and if this does set any sort of precedent, you know, going forward.
Exactly. So.
Yeah, and if worse comes to worse, if there's somebody in our audience that wants to tell them about their own volunteering experiences, contact us. We'd be curious to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, I'd love, you know, either, hell, we could have you on the show, you could just send us a nice audio comment, or we could arrange something else, who knows. But that'd be interesting. All right, why don't we get into the last topic, which... one of our listeners actually suggested to us, which was, how does our real life experience, how has our real life experiences actually affected the way we run or play RPGs? I thought this was fascinating because I think intrinsically we all do this at a certain level. And I can say I can go back to gaming with a bunch of people that were in the military. And so we were, you know, playing Twilight 2000, and some of those people were like, that piece of equipment doesn't work that way. Kind of thing. You know, it's kind of what annoys you, but at the same time it's like, well, that's cool. Well, let's make sure it works the way it's supposed to work. Kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the major ways that I think gaming has always affected the way we play, is that it allows us to inject a certain level of, I don't know if realism is the right word, but I'm going to go with realism for lack of a better word, into, you know, a system that, you know, maybe the system doesn't really apply that kind of stuff to it. It kind of gives us sometimes our backgrounds give us the ability to inject more life into something than what's written on the page.
Yeah, I would say that that's definitely the case. I think also sometimes, you know, our choice in games and the style of games that we like to play sometimes also is reflected in, you know, what we've done in gaming prior to then, and, you know, also, like you said before, maybe, you know, some of the things that we have done in our lives. You know, we look at a particular game system and go, well, wait a minute, that's a little too fantastic for me. I know how this works in real life, and so therefore, you know, this system completely ignores that, and so that's not for me.
Well, and again,
the system focuses more on that, and I'm like, oh, well, that's more up my alley.
Yeah, but I think a lot of times, some of the real life experiences, I guess, I mean, to take a really good example, people may or may not know this. I don't want to say I'm a member of a group. That sounds like part of a militia. I actually go out and do some tactical training with a bunch of guys. You know, we pay for it. I do it for fun. I'm not expecting to bust down doors any day soon. Although, for people's information, yes, I know how to actually breach a door and search a house.
You'll be ready for the apocalypse.
Pretty much, you know. But it's interesting because doing those type of things, it gives me an appreciation for tactics. And it's weird because, especially when you do miniature games, our games with miniatures are where positions important. It's amazing. It's amazing how people go like, "Well, we're going to be in this grouping," and I'm like, "You're in the, you know." Take an example. I'm running a Tour of Darkness campaign right now, which is, you know, Savage Worlds, you know, Vietnam.
Yeah.
With horrors, and they've already faced some interesting horrors already. But the, you know, the problem is that it's like, dude, you guys are in a freaking grenade kill circle, everybody. What the hell are you guys doing? You know, that's what the military calls a clusterfuck. You know, there's a cluster of people in one location. You know, okay. I mean, you know, and again, you have to give players buys because it's like they don't have the same background. But it's like, on the other hand, it's like they're like, you know, yeah, the best that they can do. You know, it's like, so you do apply some tactics to the opposing team. Sometimes you have to say, okay, well, these guys aren't really good at tactics, so I'm going to do some stuff that, for people that aren't as tactical, and then these guys are elite, so therefore they use better tactics. And it's just like, you know, people, you know, they don't understand. I only got one guy. Why am I only getting one guy with my grenade? Well, that's because they're not idiots. You know, there's a reason that there's that spacing. you know, yeah. And then you do things. It's like, or a classic example, it's like, don't, you know, just basic things like, hey, you're a superior force. Why would the other force continue to fight? They're like, screw this, we're retreating. And they're like, yeah, why did they, we didn't get to kill everybody. Why would you? They're not going to stick around and everyone die to the last man all the time. That's inappropriate, you know? And so sometimes I think that's what comes, you know, those type of things affect our game. You know, how we, you know, as a game master, well, how are you going to run this NPC? You know? You know, you talked about, Chris, you talked about the fact that you wanted to be an archaeologist or, you know, and I've known a lot of people that were gamers, that were anthropologists, archaeologists. And, you know, they bring that whole, you know, like when you play Call of Cthulhu, they bring all that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you do. You do your homework. You do the cultural stuff. My primary work was at a head smash in Buffalo Jump, which basically is one of the most extensively used places where they used to run buffalo off a cliff.
Yeah.
Which was no small feat. And so basically in the underside, there's a bunch of fragments. And it was kind of interesting just seeing the different procedures and how they would do that and so forth. Like, it is possible to herd a small herd over a cliff. And here's how you do it.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much long and short of it when it comes to that stuff there. Or those stupid little facts. In fact, I would argue that you got to be careful when you use that material to some degree, because otherwise you're writing a history textbook.
Yeah, you know, no, I agree. It is interesting. You have to, you know, that's that weird line that we always have to be careful not to cross, where realism and playability. Because, I mean, it's like the infamous guns and butter argument. You know, it's like there's that weird graph where guns and butter, where they cross is where, anyway. You know, so you have a line graph where this is fun, this is accurate, you know. And it's like where they cross, you're like, okay, that's kind of the sweet spot for where we probably might want to be.
Exactly. Like a lot of post-apocalyptic or retro futures end up looking like it's happening again. Like a future Western or a future samurai culture that involves magical blades or something.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it from a little bit of logistical sources, you'd never get the same type of culture again unless you did some serious shoehorning. Like, even if ancient gods came back 10,000 years later, you probably wouldn't recognize the people they ended up reforging.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, to a different form. Like, I'm going to use my favorite and classic example, the old Rifts Japan.
Oh, God, yeah. Mm-hmm.
They literally bought back an entire samurai culture, and yet they have a high-tech Tokyo right in the middle of it. And it, I don't know, just, it works, it's fun, you turn your brain off and you do it.
Well, I mean, you know.
But part of your back of the head kind of screams and goes, no!
But, you know, I mean, that's kind of one of those weird tropes that's always existed for Japan, that there's like, I mean, I'm thinking of like, you take the old hero system and they had like Ninja Hero or eventually, you know, the Ultimate Martial Arts book. And, you know, that makes that weird assumption, especially, is that, you know, there's this, you know, the settings involve like, or even just movies from like the 80s involving martial arts at a certain level. You know, there's like this assumption that, you know, that's there's still groups of people that are practicing to be samurai or something or ninja. And I'm not, and you know, not, hey, I don't know anything about that. So it's like, it's hard to say whether or not that actually exists. Well, I'm sure there's a subset. I mean, it's just like anything else these days. I mean, there are people today that, you know, are practicing, you know, medieval sword fighting, you know? Yep. So
well, it's a funny story when you talk about that there, because stuff wasn't run down so facetiously until relatively recently, there's a lot of stuff that people are more speculating on when it comes to building shit like that.
Yeah, no.
Like, how do you actually use a good old-fashioned English longsword? We got a good idea, but a lot of it's using modern techniques as opposed to the original oldie-goldie way, because there's no recordings, there's no...
Well, I mean,
even, you got the pictures.
Well, even the fighting manuals of the time are lacking in a lot of detail, you know?
Yeah.
So they look at what is documented, and they're just like, even what's written, you have to take with a grain of salt, because some of that stuff is something that some guy thought, yeah, this is the way it should be done, versus reality.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know? So, yeah, no, I mean, that is fascinating. But, yeah, that's another thing. I mean, I know a lot of people that get into martial arts or sword fighting or whatever. And you do. They usually bring that to the table. And it's very, again, I think a lot of the stuff you try to bring to the table is flavor for that. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And, again, you know, you know, again, you know, my military experience, you know, what does that bring me? It's like, okay, yeah, I know, granted, I was in the Navy. So, you know, it's like, hey, naval stuff, you know, modern naval stuff, I can kind of imply how certain things might work. You know, you can argue, well, you know, and so it's always like, you know, you as someone who's been in the military or any military, it's like, you know, you like, for example, I love traveler scouts. I just like the idea of the traveler scout service. Trust me, if someone today stopped off and said, you know, here's a Type S scout for free, I'm like, fuck you. I'm out of here. I'm off this fucking popsicle stand.
Dude, you got know? The universe at your command.
Exactly. Where'd you go? I mean, that's like the, that's like the, I mean, you can't make a profit on that ship. My personal favorite ship out of the standard traveler ships still today is the Far Trader. You know, that one has like the little side cockpit, you know, on the one side. But, you know, I wouldn't take it out. If someone give me a scout ship, sure, go for it. You know, great little two-four-man craft. But, you know, the funny thing is you read the way the scout service was supposed to be organized, and you're just like, obviously this person had never been in the military. They have no idea how this stuff really works, the different branches, how that really works, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's like, you're like, it's so broken, I can't even correct it. You know, how do you explain that to somebody? But you can't. So, but no, I mean, that's what you do. You know, like, for example, if you're running, you know, you're like, okay, well, I know that in our military, you know, there's going to be an officer of the deck of some sort, you know, even when the ship's in port. So that makes sense that, you know, if the ship's docked and it's a military vessel, there's going to be someone freaking sitting there wait, you know, just kind of as a entry guard, if you will. You know, or, you know, and he probably has a couple of lackeys, you know, so it's like, okay, well, that makes sense. Okay. So the players decide they want to try to, I don't know. I mean, even on a merchant ship, you would assume that they would have something similar. You know, they're just not going to, you know, that's the funny thing. Have you ever noticed? It's like people act like spaceships are cars.
That is true.
Holy you know, crap. That's true. Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, we're just going to lock up the car and leave it. You know, I mean, movies like Star Wars and all that stuff reinforce that. It's like the Millennium Falcon, it was just sitting there. Who's to say someone couldn't have stolen it right out from under him right there? You know, no one was really protecting it. It was just it's one of those things where, you know, certain vehicles just have to be that way, and obviously something that small. But if you get to a capital ship, you're not going to empty the capital ship, you know?
Well, it's kind of part of that as well, because nobody wants to be the, when you go gaming... Okay, you're invading essentially the modern equivalent of a dungeon.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to be back at the place sitting there listening to the radio while your buddies are going over life and death.
No, I agree. But my argument though is not that. It's just that, you know, from a place perspective, that's the stuff you bring. You're like, well, I know that for everybody else, it's like, oh, this is a decent sized merchant ship. They're going to have people that are going to be on the boat because, you know, they're not going to empty this huge merchant ship. So you want to, you know, you can apply that. Or, you know, I mean, heaven forbid, you've researched or just, you know a little bit about sailing. Well, that affects how you might run an actual age of sail game. You know, it's like, well, you know, might affect what you know about that kind of stuff. So.
Well, and I think you can look at this even from a further perspective. You know, the game that's coming to mind to me right now is the Robotech RPG for some reason. And the reason it's coming to mind to me right now is I can think of it in this sort of perspective. I'm looking at it like this. If Jeff was to take the Robotech RPG, I can see him running it and really playing up sort of the military aspects of Robotech, because that's, you know, the style of game that, you know, would be interesting to him. It's the kind of thing that he would know, you know, most about, having been in the military. You know, he would latch onto that aspect of the game, I think, and play up more so than myself, because, you know, I'm, you know, more interested in just, you know, the anime part of Robotech. And so I might, you know, choose to play up some of the more, you know, anime-esque tropes of the game, as opposed to, you know, spending a lot of time, you know, delving into the whole military aspect of it. And it's just interesting to see how, you know, a game like that could be, you know, taken in two entirely different directions just because, you know, one of us spent time in the military and one of us didn't.
You know, I like that idea, and you've given me a crazy idea. I would love to see a RoboCop, RoboTech game that's played by a Glee Club, just to see how much of a different interpretation it'd be. And you know why, if you've ever seen the movie.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. You're right, because, you know, the way you're coming into RoboTech is because you're a big fan of the music, you're going to play that game very much differently than either me or Jeff are going to run that game.
Oh, good Lord, yes.
But that's the fun of gaming, is to see how people come, you know, and approach, you know, these games, you know, because of their life experiences and because, you know, what it is that they latch onto, you know, in these systems when they start playing them.
Oh, absolutely. Tristan, any ideas of anything that you could use to act as a focus for your own gaming?
I mean, for me myself, like as I mentioned with Robotech, you know, it's for me it's the anime aspect of it that would get me there. And you know, whenever I play like a fantasy game, certainly, you know, I take aspects from, you know, the various fantasy anime that I've seen, and I apply those, you know, to my games. Likewise, I come from a background of having read, you know, and done a lot with superhero comics, and so I play with a lot of the good versus evil tropes, you know, more so than maybe somebody who, you know, hasn't had such extensive knowledge and background in reading comic books.
Well, it certainly adds a certain element to it, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if nothing else, will give you a good excuse to wear tights.
I don't need any more excuses to wear tights.
All of a sudden, now all I can think of is, you know, the Mel Brooks movie, Robin Hood, Men in Tights.
Oh, frick, one of my faves.
In men in tights. Anyway.
Hey, 20th level Ranger has a Patriot arrow. I think that's non-negotiable.
How about you? I mean, anything in real life that has affected the way you game?
Well, you've heard my chronological background here. Yeah. Mostly I do computer and tech support. A lot of what I do nowadays feels less like technical skills and more like people skills. So there's a lot of social
interaction
where you basically got to play nice doggy with anybody you're dealing with, especially if they're angry, grumpy, or what have you. And the trick is just trying to make sure you find that sweet spot. And I could see something like a game I just found recently called Murders and Acquisitions that I just put the Kickstarter, where it'd be fun to see what you could do in a more violent version of a regular office. Kind of like the old joke of the old first edition Papers and Paychecks.
Right. All of a sudden, the only thing I can start thinking on, it's like, it'd be kind of like Klingon office politics.
Oh, yeah. Or that Office Space scene, and you know which one I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Great fax machine, be it down.
Oh, fantastic!
I think there's an RPG waiting to be born. Klingon Office Politics.
Okay. Oh man! As soon as they release the Klingon language to open source, yeah, that might be fun.
Well, you know, there was an argument that a friend of mine once made, that he says, you know, the problem with Star Trek is that it's like, he says, I don't know how long the series would last, but it's like, it'd be fun just to do an entire series of just the Klingons.
I think Bird of Prey would be a stroke of genius if they ever did it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
You know, they're obviously an empire, they're multicultural, but we know virtually little about them beyond that they like to, they basically have lobsters on their head and they dress like heavy metal guys.
Yeah, that's a good point. Valid points.
Yeah. You know, of course, I like Worf as much as the next guy, as well as Martok, and you know, DS9 was awesome, but we know little compared to two minor races, the Bajorans and the Cardassians.
It's true.
Yeah. I don't know why, but all of a sudden I'm just thinking of, you know, okay, Klingons, and then they'd have the Human Federation, you know, cross-decking officer for comic relief.
Yeah. Usually gets handed the mop and bucket.
Sorry, that's just hilarious. All right. It really is interesting how, you know, I do think that no matter what game you play, so many of our, you know, your real life experiences, whatever they may be. You know, again, you were talking about, you know, I'm a computer tech guy, believe it or not. And I think that, I mean, it maybe not affects the how I game, but it definitely affects the games I choose to play. I love Cyberpunk, but I would in any Cyberpunk game, I think all the net running rules are so silly that I can't ever use them.
Well, the problem is, with most net running games, although there might be exceptions out there, if they are, let us know, is they become a special snowflake set of rules. Unless they're integrated with the rest of the system, you either are playing for the net runner or you're playing for the rest of the party.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. And I mean that's very, very true. You know, and it's just like, yeah, it's, you know, the net running stuff's a fun read, but again, either that's not practical, and it's like, and you're just like, that's just not the way it works. You know, I mean, in terms of a movie, for all its faults and all its weird stuff, I like watching Hackers because I think it's funny. And even though it's dated and a lot of it's wrong, some of it is right enough that you're just like, yeah, that shit actually used to happen. You know?
Dude, the best way to hack any computer system is social engineering.
Well, you know, it's like, but I'm just saying, it's like, you know, I remember, it's like, you know, they would dive dumpster diving. People used to do that. And I, honestly, people probably still could and still get an amazing amount of information. You know, mm-hmm. We rely on technology so much that sometimes low tech is the better way. Mm. You know, I don't know. It's just it's just one of those things. It's just like, you know, the one guy who supposedly had a photographic memory just walking around watching people log in and memorizing all of that shit. I mean, come on. I don't know. That's just that, you know, or Sneakers. You ever seen the movie Sneakers?
It's Robert, been a while, but
Robert Redford,
yeah. The back
Dan
of my head.
Aykroyd.
Yeah.
River Phoenix.
Yeah, it sounds familiar.
You know, a lot of it was completely silly, especially the box that decodes anything.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, but other than that, it's just like, you know, people, you know, actually used to do that or still do that for a living. You know, they break into places to prove security. And it's like, man, that's such a, I don't know, that would be, I don't think I could do it, but that would be like, you know, that'd be an interesting setup for a game, I think. That's what the player characters are, you know, that kind of group. I don't know how long I couldn't run that, but that'd be an interesting game to play.
Oh, it'd be a fascinating game to play. Would remind me a lot of playing my old Ninjas and Super Spies campaign from back in the day.
Yeah.
Oh, funny story on that.
What, Ninjas and Super Spies?
A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, it seems to be my regular trope. Basically, they ended up building our characters back when we were kids, essentially. And the whole goal was to basically play tag with each other, with martial artists. It got violent. And it was bizarre because one of the guys was like a Moogie Gong guy. So
oh God.
He would tag you with anything, any weapon. Like, it's basically the any weapon character.
Yes.
Long story short, I got taken down by a spatula.
Oh, Ninjas and Super Spies.
All of a sudden, all I'm thinking about, not that there was a spatula involved, but I was just thinking about that movie, Remo Williams.
Oh, God.
Oh, yes, yes.
I know.
I think I remember in the back of my head.
Yeah. Fred Ward. I was actually watching something else of his recently, because it's on Amazon Prime.
Oh, jeez.
Cast a Deadly Spell.
That movie is fantastic.
It's kind of dated now when you watch it, but it's still, for a concept, it's great.
It's film magic noir.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, it has Clancy Brown in it, and therefore it goes up a full point in my books.
Clancy. Yeah, he's been in a lot of strange things when you look at it, you know?
Yes, he has.
You know, it's like you never realize. It's like, oh my God, and he was in Highlander, he was in Shawshank Redemption, and quite a few other things.
Yep.
So,
oh yes, again, he's my favorite version of Lex Luthor, bar none.
Oh, indeed, his work on the Justice League animated series was fantastic.
Yeah, I have no further comment.
Fair enough.
We'll put the ties to the side and we'll just keep on going to the next part.
I think that's it. Is there anything else we really need to talk about on that?
No, I think we covered it pretty well.
I don't think we covered it pretty well. I think we just bullshitted away.
No problem. The only last minute comment I could say is cross-indexing, man. Think about it. Basically, I got a friend of mine, or is it somebody I read, where better living through, better office supplies. Basically, the idea that you basically keep yourself organized because you treat it like a business when you're organizing your GMing stuff.
Mm.
And you just sort of get your cross, you make sure all your papers are together and organized. It's no different than trying to prepare a proposal for a business, so. You know, I got a friend of mine who literally uses those little color flags to try to keep their stuff sorted. You know, a bit of a grognar, but that's part of her fun.
Yeah, you know, I don't keep my gaming stuff as organized as I probably should. Mostly because I have a lot of shit. And it's like a lot of my stuff now is just in storage because I just don't use it.
Yeah.
I just can't. But my gaming stuff is one of the few things that I just... And everything that's happened in my life, you know, my ups, my downs, the gaming stuff are the one things that I don't sell. Or get rid of.
No, I understand that completely. That's why we're here.
Well, no, I mean, I'm just saying. I mean, I look at... I mean, I have... You know, it's like... I like to say I like to collect games that I don't necessarily play, but I think are interesting. You know? And I've even been told that certain games I own don't exist.
Wow! That sounds like an anecdote.
Yeah, well, there was... Honestly, when you read the rules, it's a sucky game, as far as I can tell. I've never played it. But there was a game called Reichstar. I've actually been told by some people, that game doesn't really exist. Why do I have a physical copy, then?
You know, that's almost when you want to show up in, like, your Snapchat or whatever you decide to do, is put a picture of it and say, it's here, see?
Yeah, well, I mean, that was just something that somebody, this was a long time ago, someone told me, it never really existed. I'm like, okay. You know, and then it's like, you know, I have... things that I consider quasi-collectible, I guess, for just myself, just because I think it's interesting, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm sensing a pattern here with this reference, but I have the old hero game, is it Wings of the Valkyrie?
Yeah, that's the World War II one you were talking about?
Yeah, that they recalled.
Yeah, I remember hearing that in the back of my head.
Yeah, it's a time-traveling adventure, and it got recalled because since the players, to make sure that history happens as it should, have to stop other people from killing Hitler. Huh. And a whole bunch of people claimed that it was anti-Semitic, so they had to pull it.
But we're killing Hitler. We're not killing Hitler. Shoot.
Right, exactly.
Oh, well.
You know, and it's just one of the... Because, you know, the whole point of it was supposed to give... It was supposed to be that whole moral dilemma problem for the players. You know? Basically, you either live in a society... You either accept the society as it is, which is where the U.S. becomes almost worse than Nazi Germany. Or you save Hitler, let a whole bunch of millions of people die because of that, but yet history turns out differently. You know, that's your moral, you know, you have to make that, you know, that choice. It's a moral dilemma. And, you know, like I said, someone decided, you know, so I own that. I used to own a game called Justifiers, which I thought was a kind of an interesting little set, you know, rule book. I don't know where the hell my rule book ran off to, which is much the pity. Where the whole, it was a science fiction game where the concept is that they genetically engineer humanoid animals to do one, you know, like to teleport to another planet to, as they call it, justify the planet for both the colonization, exploration.
Wow.
You know,
that sounds intriguing.
And the concept is that, you know, as is being, you're owned by the corporation. So every player starts with a buyback number and eventually you pay off your buyback and you become, you know, you're no longer an indentured servant /slave, basically.
Sounds like an RPG version of Brutal Force, of all things.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, it exists, and it's like, you know, like I said, it was a interesting concept. It really, the game rules were not that thick. It was just a few, I mean, the rule book was like the size of maybe one of the old little black books. It really was not that big. Maybe a little, you know, page count a little higher, but it was kind of in a small format. And the only thing I have for it anymore is like one adventure. I don't have the rest of the rules anymore. But which is a shame, because like, I'd love to have a copy of that again, just for fun. You know,
maybe it'll be one of your bundles. You look for it.
I don't think there is. I don't think the company exists per se.
Yeah.
I don't know what if one of the listeners knows, let me know. That'd be interesting to know. So, but yeah, I guess that's what it is. I collect games at a certain level. You know, I don't collect games as much as I used to, but, you know, it's like, I used to, you know, it's like, oh, this is a cool and interesting thing. It's like sometimes, you know, I would just collect games that I wouldn't necessarily play. You know, it's just like, oh, that's kind of a cool concept. I mean, like, for example, I own Mouse Guard. I don't play Mouse Guard. You know?
Fair enough.
Mm-hmm. Not because, you know, I find it interesting. I like the whole concept, but it's just like, the Burning Real system doesn't do much for me. And I'm sorry about that, folks.
No problem. Yeah, I understand completely. I own a copy of Expeditions in the Barrier Peaks, even though I probably will never play it again.
Yeah.
Because it was such a fun, unique experience, but it's definitely dates back to the first edition.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. I think we've done the topic to death. We're actually a little over our hour. So, okay. Any closing comments?
No, I think that pretty much covers it.
All right. We will say adios then. We will tell people, if you want to send us a comment on anything we said or anything we didn't say, and you thought we should have, you can send us an email at info@rpgcircus.com. You can go to our Facebook page, our homepage, website, and click on the send us a voicemail, which will launch the SpeakPipe application, and you can just say away your comment, and then we'll have a nice little audio file that we can play on the next episode. You can also go to our Facebook page, our RPG Circus Google Plus page, and just post a comment there. You can post a comment, honestly, on the episode when it comes to our website. We don't really usually get a lot of those, but sometimes we do. And I think that's it. Stickers. I did send out some more stickers to some people. So I do that still. The only thing you have to do is give me a topic in return, which is where we actually got one of our topics for this episode. So thank you. That was very cool of you guys. And I still extend the offer. If people want to just come on and for an episode and just chat with us, chat or just, I don't know what the hell is what we do. just rap, as they say, with us. That offer is always extended. You just have to be able to work within whatever day that we decide to record. So, I mean, and that, you know, that's always up for debate. So, I think that's it. Anything else? I know I keep asking that, but I can't think of anything else.
No, I think it covered it all.
All right, let's play the bumper, and we'll close out this episode. RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons Attribution US License 3.0. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.